Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of the New Books Network, and I'm talking to Dr. Sean Griffin today, who's written a book on the, it's called The Liturgical Past in Byzantium and Early Rus. So thanks for being on the show and talking to me for a bit, Dr. Griffin.
Of course. Thanks so much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
So first off, since we haven't talked before, could you tell us a bit about how you got into Russian studies to begin with? Just kind of introduce yourself to the listeners.
Sure. Oh, goodness. That is quite a colorful tale, actually. I would try to keep it brief. I have a tendency to pontificate at length. So if at any time I'm going too long, feel free to cut me off. But no, it's actually... It all started kind of like the subject of this book we're going to talk about today. It started as a religious conversion. So I am living in Malibu, California in the early 2000s and living a very hedonistic and fun life kind of in the hills of Malibu, going to Pepperdine. And very unexpectedly, I had a conversion to Christianity and then eventually to the Russian Orthodox Church. And I was what they call a, convertitis, or, I basically went overboard and went to all the services and thought, oh, I'm going to be a monk or I'm going to be a priest. I came into the church at this wonderful cathedral, this old Russian cathedral in Los Angeles, right next in a place called Silver Lake near Hollywood. It has this wonderful kind of white Russian immigrant history, like Rachmaninoff's piano is in the church hall. And so I started going to all of the liturgical services that I was received into the church. And I started learning Russian because I wanted to be able to chant the services in Slavonic. And if I was going to be a priest, I needed to speak Russian so I could, help take care of the Russian-speaking parishioners. I eventually decided I was way too big of a jerk to be a priest. and so I went to graduate school in Russian studies, mainly because the gentleman who sang next to me in the choir was the chair of the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at UCLA. And so I was very drawn to his enthusiasm for this field. And he was a very kind man named Professor Ronald Vern. So that's my myth of origins for how I ended up in this zany profession.
Academia is a great place for those of us who are socially challenged, as you said. I always like hearing how people get into the field because nobody's story is the same. Everybody has a different, as you said, myth of origin. So could you start off maybe just by talking about your book's main thesis? Because I wanted to mention to the audience here that, for a popular audience, on first glance, the thesis of your book could seem maybe a little obscure, but actually it has pretty wide implications that start to kind of become pretty apparent once you get into it. So I thought maybe it'd work best to just have you start off by talking about what's the main thesis of your book and kind of what are its broader implications for studying the history of the early Rus?
Sure, of course. So I think the easiest way to describe the thesis is to tell the story of how the project came to be. So I am sitting in Professor Gail Linhoff's course on medieval Rus at UCLA, where I was a graduate student. And we were reading the Povest Vremenikiet, or what I call in the book, the Rus Primary Chronicles. So the foundational historical document of the East Slavs, which was compiled, the general consensus is that it was compiled in the 1110s by a monk at the key of Monastery of the Capes, but that it contains much, much older materials, and including the original historical documents of the Land of Rus. So we're reading the very famous story about Princess Olga's baptism in Constantinople in 955. And I just mentioned, remember how I was saying I went to all the liturgical services? So I knew kind of Byzantine liturgy in the Slavonic tradition. I knew it very well in large sections by heart, actually. And we were reading this story, and I just said kind of off the cuff to the professor, you know, a lot of this language is taken from the liturgical services. He looks at me and kind of says, I don't think anybody's ever noticed that. You should write a dissertation about it. And so I did. And it ended up the what I discovered, you know, so the project kind of started with this tiniest of archaeological, philological finds, right? A few lines of text in this one story. But as I dug deeper and deeper into the text, what I call in the book my philological excavations. I really liked this like archaeological metaphor that I kept using. What I discovered was that this tiny philological discovery at the very beginning led to a much, much larger and hopefully more significant discovery, which is that the myth of Christian origins for Rus. So these are the very celebrated and well-known tales of Princess Olga's baptism and her burial, the conversion of Rus in 988 by Prince Vladimir and his conversion, and then, of course, the martyrdom of Princess Boris and Gleb, his sons, in 1015. The big argument of the book is that these narratives actually derive, in some respects, in some very important respects, from the liturgical services of the Byzantine Empire. So I excavated the liturgical subtext of this foundational early medieval historical document.
So I think now might be a good time to have you go over a bit of just the history of the primary chronicle in general, because that's probably not something people are familiar with. And as you know, yeah, of course, I learned a pile about that from the book myself. It's quite a long and tortured road. So could you, for the interested layman, go over how the primary chronicle ended up in its present form and some of the, you know, kind of interpretive controversies over it?
Oh, goodness. Well, you could spend years of your life recounting the 250-year history of the study of this notoriously complex document. So, to make an extremely long story short, the document that we have now and that we call the Rus Primary Chronicle does not actually exist anywhere with that name and title on it. All right. So we have many much later codices, right? So manuscripts that contain what we call the Rus Primary Chronicle, the Povestvim Nikliet, as a part of themselves. Okay. And the name, so Povestvim Nikliet is one of the main phrases of the opening of the documents, a tale of bygone years. And the history of the study of this document begins in the 18th century with a German named Schlotzer, who comes to the country to what he had been trained in the methods of German philology, and he came to Russia and to St. Petersburg. And I think in one of his letters he wrote, I saw a field ripe for harvest, but there were no workers. Okay. And he found the prevailing philological practices of the Russians to be, I think his words were, barbaric. So he basically was the first to realize that, much like the Old Testament, the New Testament, or, you know, the epic poems of Homer, these stories contained in these codices could not be taken at face value, right? That there was a long history of compiling and redacting and editing and re-editing, and that, but he very interestingly thought that this text was written at one place and one time by the famous chronicler Nestor, okay? this, and so his goal was to look at all the manuscripts and compare them all, and through this comparison, find the one true text that Nestor originally wrote in the early 12th century in Kiev. There are five main manuscripts of this foundational account, and the real intellectual giant, or the real giant of the field, is a guy named Alexei Shakhmatov, who was this child prodigy in late 20th century St. Petersburg. And Shakhmatov is the guy that for him, it wasn't even the original creation of Nestor, which Schlosser was so interested in. He wanted to identify all of the component parts that predated Nestor, okay? And this kind of became what the history of chronicle studies in Russia and Ukraine, well, really the whole Soviet Union, this is, you know, Shakhmatov basically set the course for the history of studying this document for the whole of the 20th century and even to today. And so most chronicle scholars, or a great deal of them, have been preoccupied with non-extant texts and the reconstruction of these non-extant texts, which is honestly a highly speculative endeavor, but has been taken for granted for, you know, over a century now, that this is the way that chronicles can be studied and should be studied. And what I kind of point out in the book is that one of my big interventions is I'm trying to suggest that the past in early medieval Rus may actually be located fundamentally somewhere else than just inside these chronicles. So we've had this picture of early medieval history writing in which a monk, usually called Nestor, is sitting kind of hunched over his writing desk, and he has his ink pots and his pen and all of these perhaps earlier chronicles and saints' lives and treaties and all sorts of stuff. And he's there kind of compiling and redacting them. And for a guy like Shakhmatov, every redaction was a very political act, right? So basically, chronicles in Shakhmatov's view were usually brought into existence when a new prince came to power, and they placed that prince kind of in the illustrious sacred history of going all the way back to Prince Vladimir, right? What I suggest in the book is, well, actually, maybe the past for these clerical writers was mainly located liturgically, because my contention is medieval history writers were worshipers first and history writers second. They spent far more time, because they were monks, right? They were monks, they were priests, maybe a few of them were even bishops, we don't know. But they spent their life in a liturgical world, immersed in the liturgical cycles, morning, evening, night. The church books were constantly in their hands and in front of their eyes. And what most secular scholars who didn't have unexpected and dramatic conversion to orthodoxy as a 20-year-old and then didn't spend 5 years of their life immersed in liturgical services, you know, what they weren't able to perceive because they didn't have that kind of strange subjective experience is that liturgy, I believe I called it in the book, is an imperial Roman political technology for the creating and controlling of cultural memory. What does that mean? Liturgy tells a story. Liturgy tells a sacred story. Liturgy tells a sacred story about the sacred past. And it's not just the past of Jesus Christ and the Virgin Mary and the apostles. It's also a liturgical past that is permeable, and that later generations and later countries, empires can enter into. So if you, even to this day, if you go to an Orthodox service, you're hearing about the conversion of Constantine. You're hearing about the conversion of Vladimir, right? The liturgical past didn't stop happening. And so one of the big arguments I make in the book is that the origins of history writing in Kiev were probably actually clerics thinking, or not thinking, I don't even know if this was conscious and done. It was just after several generations of liturgy being in the land of Rus, you know, these guys were immersed in the services and they would hear these sacred stories about Constantine and his mother Elena. And they began to have this internalized sacred model for what the conversion of a land to Christianity should look like. And what I claim in the book is that eventually, when it came time to write what I call the myth of origins of the land of Rus, those deeply internalized liturgical paradigms or models about Constantine, about Yelena, about the martyrs, about the apostles, about a whole other host of colorful characters from the what I call the liturgical past, that they instinctively drew on those internalized kind of myths in order to create the story of the baptism and conversion of the land of Rus. Does that make sense? That was a lot.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. The side question that occurred to me as you were talking there is, so you mentioned when you were talking to your professor that she said that nobody'd ever noticed that before, right? So it occurs to me that, I mean, as part of the reason, is the Soviet context then part of why probably nobody's noticed that before? Is that because arguing that, you know, history comes from history, I guess, comes from liturgy is, yeah, I mean, isn't a very good fit with, you know, official state ideology, right? I mean, is there some kind of, you know, paradigmatic expectations about what counts as evidence and what doesn't that would prevented, like, Soviet scholars from considering a thesis like yours?
That's definitely a big part of it. But I should give credit where credit is due. My professor, Gail Linhoff, was not aware of this one study by a scholar, a post-Soviet scholar. It was written in like the early 90s, maybe like 94. I think her name is Asokina. And she actually pointed out in this kind of very obscure little article that a couple of the phrases from the Baptism of Olga, the very same thing I noticed, had come from a couple of hymns to the Theotokos, so the Mother of God, the Virgin Mary. So credit where credit is due. She was actually the first one to ever publish anything suggesting this. But she certainly didn't excavate the much bigger picture. And I was, of course, not aware of this work until I had already done most of my research. But no, it's a great question. To me, and in the, I think it's the end of the second chapter, I address this exact question, except for me, it wasn't the Soviet context that perplexed me, because like you suggested, that seems pretty obvious, right? Like there is a reason that the liturgical sources would not have been documentary evidence of the highest sort in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
But what really surprised me, what is really harder to understand is how this was not discovered in the Imperial Russian era, right? Because the Russian Empire was obviously Orthodox. There were churches everywhere. Was it just as simple as that by that time, the intellectual elite was already so thoroughly secularized that they didn't go to church?
That was what occurred to me when you said that.
But the thing is, so the person, the figure that I explicitly draw attention to in the book is a guy named, I think his name is Nikolai Serebryanikov or Serebnikov. I wrote the book, you know, published 5 years ago, was writing a lot of this stuff 7-8 years ago. So it's not as fresh in my mind as perhaps it should be. But I draw attention to this guy because he was the son of a priest. He studied at a theological seminary. And then he studied precisely the stories I was talking about Prince Vladimir, Princess Olga, and all these figures. And it's astonishing to me that this person who knew the services inside and out did not identify the liturgical sources of the Chronicle. And I think that part of it is we just have to, for somebody that like him came from a believing background, the way we're comfortable with deconstructing myths today, I think would have possibly been very uncomfortable for him in that period of time and in the intellectual and ecclesiastical environment that he was within, right? So I think he might have been at Sergei Posad, I can't remember. But, you know, if he had been doing research that suggested that the stories about St. Prince Vladimir and St. Boris and Gleb are in fact just myths that were based on narratives from earlier Byzantine, you know, liturgical services, and that therefore the whole, you know, what they saw was kind of real true history of Islamic civilization, that all of this is actually just a set of stories, a set of myths that may have never really happened, that would not have made him very popular at that time, at that place. So that's my best guess for how a person like that did not perceive these sources. But it's just that. It's only a guess. I don't know. It really does beg your belief that this was not identified earlier, in my opinion.
Yeah, maybe now would be a good time for you to bring up just what are some pretty good, like particularly good pieces of evidence that stand out to you where you can really see this kind of direct transfer of here's what we say and do in liturgy. Here's what shows up in the Chronicle. Are there some particularly good ones that you could mention to the listeners that would kind of put meat on the bones of the thesis you've sketched out?
Of course. So let's just do a few greatest hits.
Yeah.
Favorites that I can recall. So when you're looking at, for instance, the baptism of Princess Olga, you know, what I document in extraordinarily tedious, boring philological detail of the book. Like, that's the thing. It's really a book of two different halves. The first half is kind of like, I had to write three chapters. I had to write half the book just so that the kind of hardcore textual stuff in the second half of the book would be comprehensible to a non-specialist audience. Because it was very important to me that the book, if anybody was actually interested in it, that the book could be read by people who didn't know a thing about this. And not just for, you know, the 12 or 20 specialists in early Rus history that are in the world. So for instance, if you look at the story of the baptism of Princess Olga, there are whole parts of the baptismal service, you know, that appear in the text for Saint Olga, right? I think as many as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. If I remember correctly, that line's in there. There's exact wording from the services for Saint John the Forerunner and this whole class of saints who were kind of like holy forerunners. That's the thing you have to remember. So the monks have internalized this paradigm, this sacred myth for what a national conversion should look like. I mean, use the word national there in air quotes, right? Like, this is before the modern nation state. And so a figure like Vladimir has to have a holy forerunner. And so Olga becomes both Saint John the Forerunner and a whole host of kind of like saints, Joachim and Anna, and all these other sacred forebears, right? So she serves that role. And at the same time, her own baptism is described using the actual prayers and petitions from the Byzantine baptismal service. So that's one example. Vladimir, I think a lot of different claims about Vladimir in the book, and it's much too much detail to go into now. But my favorite one, and the one that really raised the most eyebrows, is that I asked the question, does the Rus Primary Chronicle depict Vladimir as the first bishop of Rus? Which is an absolutely crazy thing to suggest, because we know historically this would never have happened. And this was one of the things that I think some of my readers, some of them struggled to perceive, that I was not talking, in the book, I'm not talking about real history as it really happened, right? I am talking about historiographical perceptions and constructions, right? Like, early medieval historians have been aware for many decades now that history is a construct, okay? We, you know, a written text, especially a text as old as the Rus Primary Chronicle, you know, this is, I'm not going to say it's highly dubious, but we need to be very, very aware of the constructedness of these texts, right? And as you rightly pointed out earlier, the history of their transmission and copying and editing and all these things. Because what we learn, and what a whole host of medieval historians in working in many different fields and in many different locations across the world, you know, these historical documents usually tell us as much or more about the environment in which they were written and the political context of the time that the history was written. It tells us as much or more about that than it does about the actual history itself. And so when I'm claiming Prince Vladimir is depicted as the first bishop of Rus, I'm looking at the way he's presented in this manuscript, and I'm using exactly. So basically, my argument was that the story of his conversion in Kirson, the famous story about, you know, he declares he'll be baptized if the city is miraculously, the siege is miraculously ends, that this is all based on the narratives and the service of Saint, about Saint Constantine. But from the moment Vladimir is baptized and he's blinded in a moment of baptism, he's miraculously cured, a very, very classic motif in these kinds of conversion tales. The chronicle tells them very, very concretely that Vladimir, you know, he gets relics, he takes a retinue of priests, he takes liturgical instruments, he takes icons, and he heads back to Kiev. What is interesting is that there's very one important kind of figure that he does not head back to Kiev with, and that is the figure of a bishop. Okay? Then, when Vladimir goes into the baptismal waters in 988, he again says the prayers that include elements that only a bishop would pray at very specific times. And then when he goes into what's called the Church of the Tithes in 996, he again prays this another high priestly prayer. And in this one, he says, "Oh Lord, look down from heaven, you know, at this vine which thy right hand hath planted," which is a prayer that only bishops pray in what's called a hierarchical liturgy. So I made the argument that the chronicler is going to great lengths to specifically connect Vladimir to the figure of a bishop, because these are words during a service that are so tied to a type of liturgy that only the bishop can serve. Okay? So, and again, the point I made was, I think the chroniclers are depicting Vladimir in this sacerdotal role, in this pseudo-liturgical role, because that is precisely how Constantine is portrayed in the liturgical hymns, to the point where one of the hymns claims, you know, that, it's something like Constantine anointed the church with oil and water or something like this. And again, it's this direct reference to what only bishops do during a consecration service. So, and then my favorite one probably is the martyrdom of Boris and Gleb, as I made an argument that the entire structure of their martyrdom is based on the rite of proskomedia, which is, so before an Orthodox liturgy, the priest is in the altar by himself, and there's this very elaborate, very beautiful service for preparing, you know, the bread, the host, that will later be consecrated into the body and blood of Christ, okay? And what I show in the book is that everything, or a great many things, that are said of and happen to the host as being prepared for sacrifice are precisely the things that happened to Boris and Gleb, and that if you look at the order of liturgical materials that appear in their story, their tale of martyrdom, it mirrors the exact ordering as it would have occurred going from matins to first hour to third hour to proskomedia to divine liturgy. And when I argue that Boris is depicted as the high priest and that Gleb is the spiritual sacrifice or rational sacrifice offered up, you know, it is martyrdom as an offering. And like another really concrete example really quickly is that the way the chronicler describes Gleb's death, he uses the words a rational sacrifice or a spiritual sacrifice. The translation in English is not great. And that's exactly the word that the priest prays as he's holding up the gifts at the moment of consecration. Okay, so his brother Boris basically prays the prayers that the priest would have prayed, and then it's Gleb that is the actual sacrifice. That was the kind of deep structural argument I made about the tale of Boris and Gleb. Does that help? Is that the kind of stuff you were looking
for? Yeah, exactly. I thought that would enable people listening to see some practical examples of how the liturgical language gets transmitted.
But again, I should stress, this is highly like complicated, detailed stuff, and you've really got to read the book if you're gonna, you know, buy the argument. You should not believe what I'm saying just based on vaguely recalled examples that I'm giving at the moment.
What I do periodically, just so you know, get emails from people who tell me that after they listen to these interviews, they usually go buy the book. So people might actually want to dig into it a little more. You know, it occurred to me as you were talking there that maybe part of this is kind of a failure of historical imagination on the part of us moderns, just blanket assuming that what evil monks think history is for is what we tend to think history is for. Because, I mean, they're kind of collapsing what we think of as the past and the present, right? You know, Constantine is sort of present, you know, for the chroniclers in ways that, you know, we would find, you know, deeply dubious. Is that, I don't know, does this seem plausible to you that we're kind of grafting onto the past an answer to the question, what's history for? That really wouldn't have made sense to the compilers of the Chronicle, whoever they were.
Yes, very much so. And I make that argument at length in the book. The chief sin or error or mistake or problem that I identify with, especially positivist historiography about the Middle Ages, is that it's deeply anachronistic, and that many, many medieval historians have taken a very modern conception of what history is and where history is made and how history is transmitted, and they have projected that vision back onto an early medieval past that did not know anything about that. But I think, and this is where, I mean, in a way, and especially the second or the third chapter, I lay a lot of blame on the Enlightenment and on, you know, especially in the 18th century. And it is a prejudice and it's a bias that so many scholars have into the present day, is that, you know, monks were these superstitious idiots who mechanically copied things, often not even understanding what they were doing. And that's because modern historiography, and this is the reason they weren't able to identify liturgy. And it's the reason nobody thought to look into these liturgical books, because they just thought they were filled with superstitions and myths. Yeah. And they didn't realize that liturgical books are this incredible treasure trove, this incredible untapped resource for reconstructing the intellectual history and material culture and preoccupations of the medieval world. So that was one of the things my book really brings in, and I'm certainly not the first to suggest this. You know, this I call it the liturgical turn. The liturgical turn of medieval studies started in the 70s.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not the first person to like be like, we should look inside of a liturgical book in order to help write the history of the Middle Ages. And I don't want to give the impression that, you know, this was somehow like born out of my own head, like Athena from the head of Zeus or something. But yeah, that's one of the big kind of theoretical interventions I make in the work, is that we need to take these sources seriously. But one of the reasons they have not been taken seriously is because they were so ubiquitous and complex and difficult to understand. Like the way liturgy tells a story, it's not a linear text, okay? But yet liturgy was celebrated 365 days a year, morning to night, for thousands of years. And as a result, the liturgical texts are one of the like greatest achievements of human creativity, like in all of human history. Like if I had all the liturgical books for all the services in my office right now, like they'd be stacked up high. Like these are a huge amount of texts. And earlier generations of scholars thought they were very, very repetitive and not very helpful. And there was always this major distinction between like liturgists over here, just doing this very, very technical, esoteric type of manuscript studies, you know, like trying to figure out when these texts were made and who made them and when, what parts came in at what point. And then historians over here who just ignored the liturgy because they really didn't understand what it was. And the reason they didn't understand what it was is because they didn't do it. They didn't have any experience with it. You know, just understanding what church books are used at what point during a service for what feast takes a lot of understanding of the liturgical cycle. You know, like, and different books are chanted from simultaneously during the same service. So it's extremely complicated and not at all obvious to the uninitiated outsider. And so as a result, the church books were not discovered and not kind of valued for what they actually possess. because secular historians did not understand how to hear or listen to the story that the church books and the liturgical services tell, in my opinion.
You mentioned at one point that let me formulate this question correctly here. I'm getting my thoughts crossed up. You mentioned that you're tracing this usage of liturgical, you know, language into the chronicle, but you've also made the argument that gets fed back into liturgy to some extent. Like the chronicle then in turn goes back and interprets or influences liturgy, I should say. So how does that process work?
Yeah. Okay. I'm so glad you brought this up because it's one of my favorite arguments, and I kind of worry that argument gets buried because it's the conclusion of the book, and it's always unclear to me how many people actually make it to the conclusion of a like serious rigorous academic monograph.
I did.
Well, good for you. I really appreciate that. Thank you. So what you're talking about is something I call the liturgical loop, and another one of like the really big claims or hypotheses or interventions that I make in the work is that I identify what I call this liturgical historiographical liturgical loop, and I show how liturgy became history and then became liturgy again. And it was this process, which occurred over centuries of time, it was this process that allowed ruling dynasties to make the momentous transition from earthly rulers to the communion of the saints. Okay. And this is why I call liturgy an imperial Roman political technology. Like, liturgy would be, like, this is the reason I think that foreign rulers paid so much money to convert to other faiths, to Christianity, right? So if you look at Kiev in the 9th century, early 10th century, it's this very kind of diverse place that has kind of a ruling Varangian hierarchy. And the Varangians, of course, are Vikings that basically came down the riverways, and there's all of these different peoples there. And when Vladimir converts, he installs this very material infrastructure in that city, right? Like, by the time his son Yaroslav the Wise is rulers, I mean, residents are entering into Kiev through golden gates, and there's the Church of the Holy Apostles, and Byzantine clerics are praying translated Byzantine prayers, and there are Greek inscriptions on the inside of the Church of Holy Wisdom, which are still there to this day. And so I think of the book, I called Kiev a Byzantine liturgical colony. And the question I ask is, why would these Vikings, you know, these raiders and traders who, you know, were after riches, why would they choose to then spend those hard-won riches on the things of the spirit, on churches, on church books, on a professional clergy? And the classic answer has always been, you know, prestige and legitimacy, prestige and legitimacy. But what does that actually mean? Well, what I think I show in the book is that liturgy is installed, the sacred stories start being told over and over and over again. Generations of clerics internalize this story. The first generation, you know, writing the first histories, they internalize this myth, this paradigm, and that eventually leads to them creating this myth of Christian origins about Prince Vladimir, Princess Olga, Saints Boris and Gleb, who, by the way, are all relatives, right? So the ruling dynasty gets sacralized, you know? And if you are saints, all of a sudden your claims to political power are unchallengeable. Why does your clan rule this land? Because God chose you for it. And if God chose you for it, probably best to not rebel against this. You better just submit because we're in charge. Now, a number of reviewers have found this to be a rather neo-Marxist interpretation of things, which is fair. It's a completely fair critique. But just because it's a fair critique doesn't necessarily mean that what I'm saying is inaccurate. Because I think liturgy can be both. I was just at Pascha at midnight on Saturday, right? Like, I go to the liturgical services, and yes, it can be a place of communion with God, but it can also be a place for disseminating political propaganda. Today, and 1,000 years ago. And I think a lot of this imperial propaganda got baked into the liturgy very early on in the Byzantine Empire. And so the first generation of chroniclers who are clerics internalize the paradigms. They write the original myth of origins, or they edit it, whatever. These guys eventually get it to the form it's in today. And then generations of people thinking about the origins of their land, they read these tales about Vladimir, Olga, Boris, and Gleb, and they think, oh my gosh, this is just like the saints. These people are saints. Well, why do they seem like they're saints? Because they're based on the sacred paradigms from the stories of saints in the liturgy. So then they write the liturgy. We also can't think that there was like this set procedure for canonizing saints at Rus in this time. Like even today, it's not at all as kind of codified and legalistic as say the Catholic Church does it, right? Like it's the Christian East is often rather flexible in the way that it does things. And so the argument I make in the book is that saints were actually made through the way memories are made and sacralized through generations and generations and generations of clerics and people praying and celebrating and worshiping at liturgy. So eventually when the services were written for Boris and Gleb and Olga and Vladimir, those stories that were in the chronicle, which originated from other liturgical services, those stories then became the same stories in their liturgical services. So that's why I called the liturgical, historiographical, liturgical loop. And this was how, in my opinion, saints were made over several centuries. Sorry if that was much too long an answer.
No. That's quite an interesting argument you made. I thought that feedback loop sort of imagery worked quite nicely when I read the book. Last big question for you. I was wondering if you could talk, in light of everything you've said about this book here, about your next project, maybe a preview of coming attractions, as they say, because it, particularly in, what you were calling that, kind of political technology and so on, it struck me as there's quite a bit of continuity between this book and the project you're working on now. So is that something you could kind of talk about for a little bit?
Sure, I'd love to. That's very much on my mind. Because after we finish this interview, I'm going to go back to trying to figure out how to write this book. So again, I need another origin story. I'm obsessed with origin stories, evidently. So I'm writing the current project, and I was lucky enough to win a Volkswagen Stiftung Fellowship, which meant that my wife and I could live, this is before we had children, this is when I still had a life of my own. They're living in Münster, Germany, and we were in Amsterdam for the weekend, which was a lot of fun. And I'm in the bar of the hotel lobby, and I have been struggling to write the introduction to the book that is eventually called The Liturgical Pastimes, 1800s, because the beginning was boring. And I knew I needed a hook, right? I didn't know, honestly, the whole time I was working on this project, I never thought that anybody was going to read it. I never imagined that 5 years later, I'd still be doing interviews about it. I never imagined that I was going to win a bunch of awards. Like, I thought I was writing for an audience of one, which was me. Actually, two, because my poor wife, I subjected her to everything I wrote. But so we're in this bar, and all of a sudden, on a Dutch TV program, which I couldn't understand because it was in Dutch, I look up, and there is Patriarch Kirill standing next to President Vladimir Putin in 2017, I believe, or it's 2016, November 4th, and they are consecrating this gigantic 80-foot statue of St. Prince Vladimir on Borovitskaya Kloshchad, just outside the walls of the Kremlin. And then I watch as Kirill takes a liturgical instrument and does this little pseudo-liturgical ritual to bless the statue. And the stories that Kirill told in his speech and the story that Putin told in his speech were the very same stories that I was talking about in the Rus Primary Chronicle. And so I use this as the introduction to my book, which many critics described as a provocative introduction, right? But after the first project was done, one, and this sounds extremely cynical, but it's the truth. It basically, through multiple years of failure, became clear to me that I was never going to get a job as a Slavic medievalist, because for reasons that I don't agree with, the field of Slavic is basically, even Yale, the top places that have always had medievalists just decided to not replace any of them. And so I had been told for years by other people that I was going to have to develop a secondary specialization. You know, I couldn't just be a medievalist. Some people could just study Pushkin their entire life, or Dostoevsky, but I was not allowed to just study the first 800 years of a civilization. So I had a very practical need to have a different times, you know, to study a different time period in addition to the Middle Ages. And I got, you know how academics are, we're obsessives. You couldn't do what we do if we were, you know, rather strange people who get really preoccupied with things that normal people don't get preoccupied by. And I got really preoccupied with this statue. I was like, what the hell is it doing there? Why in the world is Prince Vladimir still being commemorated today by Putin and Kirill? And as I dug into the story, it led me down this rabbit hole into the bizarre and colorful and now very tragic and perverse world of the memory politics of the contemporary Russian Orthodox Church. And what I learned is that that statue was all about Ukraine. And it was all about the Imperial Russia's insistence that Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia are three yedinaya, right? They're brotherly nations, they're triune nation, they're three people are one, okay? So in the reality, I'm looking at a statue that is a warning about the later invasion of Ukraine in some respects, right? Like the Russians' continuing insistence that Ukrainians do basically not have a right to an independent nation, and that whether they like it or not, they are a part of, you know, Russian civilization, or Russki Mir, which is obviously a big problem and contributed massively to the ideological justification for the invasion. So I really wanted to know what the story of that statue was. And then that led me into all these other memory politics. And I, oh, and by the way, there's an article in the Russian Review. If this interests any of the viewers, there's an article called Revolution, Rascal, and Rock and Roll, the 120th anniversary of the Baptism of Rus. And it's a chapter of my next book, but it's also a standalone article. It won an award too, which was nice. I'll take that. Thank you. But so if any of that stuff interests you, you can find that's in the Russian Review. And but then I turned my attention to, then in 2020, during COVID, oh my gosh, there was this big scandal about the main cathedral of the Russian armed forces at Patriot Park, which was built outside of Moscow. And in this cathedral, the Soviet and imperial pasts were merged into one synthetic new construction of the Russian past, in which the Virgin Mother of God looked down at both czars and commissars, imperial soldiers and Soviet soldiers, right? So you had this incredible baptism of the Soviet past. And there were the five-pointed red star is inside this cathedral. There was originally mosaics of Putin and Stalin inside this cathedral, but they had to be taken down because they were so controversial. I had an article about this just published again in the Russian Review. It's called Putin's Holy War of the Fatherland, Sacred Memory in the Russian Invasion of Ukraine. And so if you're interested in that, you can take a look at that article as well. And so I'm writing about that cathedral. And then Putin, I'm in Helsinki. I'm actually have more recent fellowships in Europe. I was back in Helsinki, Finland. And on the day of the invasion, February 24th, 2022, I'm literally sitting at my desk writing about the memory politics of this cathedral. And those memory politics are a lot of the very same memory politics that Putin used to justify the invasion on that day. So all of that massively complicated the project I was doing, but made it of much greater interest to a lot more people. And so the book that's coming out, I'd love to have it done by December. It's probably going to not be done until the end of next summer. But there's advantages of that too, because new stuff keeps happening. Like just a few weeks ago, Patriarch Kirill introduces this document, this nakaz, at the all Russian World Council, which he founded in 93. And the nakaz clearly states this is the current conflict in Ukraine is a holy war, and after this holy war, there can be no Ukraine. So the big question now that I'm trying to answer in the book is, has the Moscow Patriarchy, you know, become this fascist? Has it been basically co-opted by fascist forces and it's blessing a holy war for the total destruction of Ukraine? That's definitely the Ukrainian, current Ukrainian narrative about the Moscow Patriarchate. But what I'm going to show in my book is that it's actually a lot more complicated than that. And Kirill is a real political chameleon. He's a political weather vane. So what he's, even though he is clearly endorsed this document, we can't just take it at face value. This is not in any way to justify or defend him, because, you know, the narrative arc of this book kind of shows what a tragic figure he is. And that, I mean, this is a guy whose grandfather was a confessor in the gulags. And in my opinion, he has now completely betrayed the faith that he is supposed to be the head of, you know, the patriarch, in order to serve the sacralization of Putin's regime. So that's where it ties in. It's like, what I'm always talking about, it seems like, in whatever project, is the sacralization of power. And what's really remarkable about Russian civilization is that that's just what they always do. Imperial period, Soviet period, post-Soviet period, Nicholas II, Stalin, Putin, there is this deep fundamental civilizational need or pattern of sacralizing the power of the state, usually at the expense of human beings' lives. So I will end it with that.
Okay. Yeah, so that's great. So then folks listening can see how there's, even though your first book there is about years that are very much bygone, and your new project is quite current, there's definitely that connecting thread there about how power gets sacralized. So hopefully when you give me a holler when you're done with the book you're working on now, and we should talk about that one too. I'd be interested in seeing what conclusions you reach.
Absolutely, I'd love to do it.
So, okay, well, I think we'll knock off there. We're right on an hour, so thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about this book.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for being interested in it.
Yeah, you bet.